May it please the court. My name is Emmanuel Colina. I represent the appellant, the Palm Family Foundation, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The foundation submitted its application to the IRS, claiming to be a supporting organization under Section 509A3 of the code, and due to the service's delays in ruling on its status, brought a declaratory judgment action under Section 7428 of the code in the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia. The District Court determined that the foundation was a tax-exempt private foundation. The remaining question before the District Court was whether or not the foundation fulfilled the requirements for a supporting org to rise to the level of being a private foundation to that of being a public charity. There are three types of supporting organizations, and the foundation is a type two, which is supervised or controlled by one or more public charities. To be a type two organization, a charity must pass three tests: the organizational test, the relational test, and the control test. The district court determined that the foundation failed the relational test.
Am I reading the articles of incorporation correctly? To say that the board of directors, by a simple majority vote, can change the manner of appointment of the board of directors. I didn't see that argued anywhere in your briefs, but as I read the articles of incorporation, it seems to say that.
The articles of incorporation provide that majority vote has to rest in the independent managing directors. So majority vote always rests with the officers, directors, and trustees of charities that are part of the supported class.
So I'm looking at Joint Appendix, I guess it's 195, and this is the Articles of Amendment and Restatement of the Articles of Incorporation. The 11th says, the corporation reserves the right to make from time to time, by the vote or written assent of a majority of its board, any amendments to these articles which may now or hereafter be authorized by law. So a simple majority vote of the board.
Yes, Your Honor.
So couldn't a simple majority vote of the board change Mr. Palm's ability to appoint the directors and officers on an annual basis?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
And he did not have control of the majority of the board, right?
No, Your Honor.
That seems rather significant to me, but I didn't see it argued by you. But doesn't that go directly to the control issue?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
So the majority of the board at any time could have changed the appointment power, which seems to be so critical to the arguments of both sides here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, that must seem quite implausible, since you didn't even argue it, that they would do such a thing. Wouldn't you think? They were picked by Mr. Palm initially, and it would be unusual, to say the least, if they were to deprive him of his ability to pick their successors.
Your Honor, it was structured specifically according to the code and the regulations so that a majority of the independent managing directors represented the charities in the supported class. This was a requirement of the law. It was not a requirement if you wanted to be a supporting organization, you had to have that structure. It was not an alternative that could have been selected. To the contrary, by Mr. Palm. Mr. Palm, needless to say, selected individuals that were independent people that he felt that he could work with. And the mere fact that he could work with them did not ruin their independence. The Byram case and a number of other cases from the Supreme Court clearly hold that these individuals still had a fiduciary duty to perform the functions and tasks that they were required to do.
Well, you make that point, I think, in your reply brief, saying there's no reason to doubt their good faith, for instance.
Yes, Your Honor.
But is there any reason we shouldn't treat as waived any separate argument along the lines that Judge Griffith mentioned?
Your Honor, the structure of the entity was based upon the law. And the fact that the...
I understand that, but you're not pointing to that as far as I can tell, and I think you agree, you're not pointing to that as one reason to doubt that Mr. Palm had control or de facto control.
Mr. Palm's ability to appoint individuals does not constitute de facto control under the law. There is no case, there's no ruling, there is nothing in the regulations that would support that.
Is there any case going the other way?
Your Honor, there is no case on the issue of control that I am aware of.
I mean, you say that the only way that he could control is if the people that he appointed violated their fiduciary duty. I'm not sure that follows at all. I mean, suppose he appointed all yes men or women, people that were of a particular philosophy or a particular bent or particularly malleable. They may not violate their fiduciary duty, and yet the people that he chose, he chose them because he could control them.
Your Honor, I would argue that we can't speculate on the control that Mr. Palm did or did not exercise. There's nothing in the record that would reflect that Mr. Palm did exercise control to have...
Well, is it actual control or is it potential control?
It is actual control or some facts on the record that would indicate that he actually did exercise control over the individuals and that they did not exercise their independence.
That would mean that the only organizations that possibly get qualified are ones that have already been in existence for a period of time, and yet it must be that newly founded organizations, which haven't even gotten off the ground yet, seek to be qualified as charitable organizations, right?
Correct, Your Honor, and that is exactly the point that we made in our brief.
Well, it's got to be potential, it can't be actual.
No, Your Honor, I disagree respectfully. I believe that the control that they're talking about in this situation is actual control that exists. Normally, when the code speaks in terms of the word control, they speak in terms of majority vote.
It's also by aggregation of positions and directly or indirectly controlling. The power of the sword of Damocles is not that it falls, but that it hangs. Mr. Palm's ability to remove people may be more important than his ever removing anyone.
Your Honor, in an analogous case...
I should say not reappointing them. Yeah, go ahead.
Your Honor, in analogous cases in the tax area, in the estate and gift tax area, a state of Wall and a state of VAC, the courts have held that this kind of ability to remove and replace an independent individual does not constitute control. And there's the IRS in their own revenue ruling in 1995 that followed that agreed.
So when you said to Judge Randolph that there was no case either way, that was on this particular reg,
yes,
but you're saying in the estate and gift tax area there is?
Yes. There is no case under 509A3C that specifically decides that. There are analogous cases under 2036A.
Can I go back to my point again? I'm puzzled why you didn't make the argument. Are you telling us in response to Judge Ginsburg's questions that that's not an argument that you're asserting? You're not relying on the ability of the board of directors in the articles incorporation to, by majority vote, to change the rule? That's not something that we ought to think about? Or?
No, Your Honor. I wish I had argued it.
Oh, okay.
The truth of the matter is that Mr. Palm created this foundation with a desire to give to charities and charitable purposes. And he wanted to work within the structure that the law permitted. And we looked at the regulations and we structured it according to the regulations.
And did you direct us to these estate and gift tax analogous rulings?
Yes, sir, I did, Your Honor.
What's the section number again? 2036A, did you say?
The section was 2036A of the code. The analogous rulings on estate of Vac and estate of Wall.
All right, I didn't see the code section,
on
but you said the cases are in there?
On page 18 of our brief, our initial brief.
Yep. Got it. Further questions?
Continue.
Further questions? You've used your time. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. John Schumann for the United States and the IRS. The district court correctly held that the Palm Family Foundation did not meet the requirements to qualify as a supporting organization under Section 509A3. Now, there are three parts to this test. We've discussed the control test, and I will also. But the foundation is presumed to be a private foundation and not a supporting organization unless it meets all three parts of this test. Here, the Palm Family Foundation fails to meet any part of any of these three parts of the test.
Will you address my concern with the 11th article and the Articles of Incorporation, which clearly allows the majority of the board, which does not include Mr. Palm, to set the ground rules here? If they didn't like the appointment power and the way he was exercising it, they could change it by simple majority vote without him at all. He's not in control under the he may be in de facto control because they like what he's doing, but clearly the charter documents put the authority somewhere else. It's in the majority of the board. They can change this at any moment.
Well, the argument, as the court has noted, was not made by the
But the control argument is made, right? I mean,
yes,
the control is clearly before us, and counsel for Mr. Palm has argued that he's not in control. So this is the same issue.
Well, I contend he's waived this argument, but even if he hasn't, there's a reason why he hasn't made this argument. It's because that sort of behavior by the board is so inconceivable that it is not something that Mr. Palm would have ever...
What does that suggest anything more than that they approve of the way that Mr. Palm is exercising the authority they've allowed him to use?
Well, in order to take this action, the board would have to essentially run rampant. They would have to have been appointed by Mr. Palm, have his blessing, and then immediately turn around and say, no, Mr. Palm, you're not allowed to...
You don't think that happens all the time in corporate America?
Well, this is not a publicly traded corporation.
No, issues of corporate governance. You don't think that happens all the time?
For a private foundation like this, where the people are known to Mr. Palm, he's appointed them for the purpose of being on this board.
Yeah, you would assume that someone would appoint someone that they know and can trust and have a relationship with, you know, right?
And
there's nothing unusual about that.
Well, that kind
of person. But in the charter documents, there's a way to replace him if they don't like what's going on.
But, Your Honor, that kind of person that he would appoint would be the person who would not be likely at all to take advantage of this article to change the entire structure of the foundation.
So is that the test for us then? Is
the IRS
personalities
has,
of the people that he appoints?
The IRS has to pass on this application for recognition based on the board that was in place at the time the application was made. Now, it could conceive of ways in which the board might be different or it might act differently, but it has to pass on the board and the foundation as it exists at the time of the application, because this entire structure is based on...
So you're saying the question for us is the likelihood of whether this board would invoke that power? That's the type of inquiry we're supposed to make?
Well, it's actually, the statutory test is more specific. It says it's control that can be either direct or indirect.
Right.
And as the articles exist now, and as the board exists now, there is at least indirect control. Now, whether that could change in the future is a different matter. Whether or not the foundation changes its articles and comes back and seeks recognition, that might be a different case. The IRS may have a different view of that. I can't presume to tell the IRS what they would do in that circumstance.
Practical answer. I think I'm hearing you, but first of all, unless I'm miscounting, there are a total of 11 votes, and Palm and his wife have 5 of them, right? And then there are 3 other directors, are there? And they each have 2 votes.
Well, actually, it depends on if you're talking about the executive committee or the board as a whole.
I think we're talking about the board.
The board. Yeah, that would be, the six would be divided among those among who are non-disqualified.
Yes, right. Sir. So there's a total of 11 votes, and the Palms have hold five of them, right? The people who signed on to the Articles of Incorporation are the pastor of a particular church and somebody else. These are the very people that the Palm Foundation would give money to, right? So the idea that what they're going to do is they're going to oust this guy and his wife is inconceivable.
Yes.
So that means they won't get any money, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That it's simply not something that would have ever occurred to Mr. Palm.
No wonder it wasn't argued.
Mr. Schumer,
sure.
That what you just agreed to raises a question. Is the money, is the foundation funded with monies from the Palms?
At this point, they are disqualified people because they are substantial contributors. So they can't
accept. The money's already in there.
There is some money in there. There may be other money coming in the future. In fact, that's, I think, the whole purpose of the.
From the same source or from, okay.
Yes, in general, yes. It can accept money from other sources, but here it's the Palm Family Foundation. It's set up to receive money from the Palm family, Mr. and Mrs. Palm. And as the Articles of Incorporation exist now and what was passed upon by the IRS, there is a right by Mr. Palm to replace these board members, and not only to replace them, but to do it on an annual basis. And as president of the foundation, he is the CEO of the foundation. He has general charge and control. Yes, the board sits above him in the corporate hierarchy, but he, of course, has de facto veto power over the foundation's actions because he is the one who appoints them and can replace them under the articles.
And if somebody resigns or leaves for whatever reason, the board can replace them, but it has to be by a two-thirds vote.
It's a two-thirds vote to remove a board member. But that would be before his one-year term expires, and presumably Mr. Palm could wait him out if there were such a thing as a recalcitrant board member, which there's no indication that there is now. Now, the foundation...
I'm a little confused here.
Certainly.
You said that the... if I've got this straight, that the... It's no wonder that the taxpayer didn't argue that there could be... that the board could change the rules and get rid of the Palms because that's virtually inconceivable. It would shut off the flow of funds. Therefore, that's not a reason for thinking that. Therefore, the board's ability to do that is not a reason for thinking what, that they're independent.
That's a reason for thinking that the board is not independent. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then your other one that you've moved on to is that he has indeed he could remove them.
Yes.
Or rather, pardon me, not reappoint one of them.
Oh, remove them. I mean replace them at the end of their...
Yeah, replace them, not reappoint them.
Yes, sir.
Do we know how much money is in the Palm Family Foundation today?
The administrative record indicates the amounts that have been placed there to this point. I don't recall the exact amounts, but it does set forth the contributions that were made to that point, and it can receive contributions. Since then, it may have.
Ballpark. I'm just trying to get some sense.
A few hundred thousand,
okay.
Can you go on to the organizational test the interpretation that you say the IRS follows when the individual or when the charitable organizations aren't named?
Yes, Your Honor. The test under the statute is whether it's organized exclusively for the benefit of or to perform the functions of or to carry out the purposes of one or more specified organizations. So the key here is what does specified mean. Now, ordinarily, the public charities that it supports must be specifically named in the Articles of Incorporation. Here, no charities were named. There is a narrow exception for charities that are designated by class or by purpose. But here, the class is so broad that it includes an essentially uncountable number of public charities. The definition of the class is those charities which support, promote, and or perform public health and or Christian objectives. So that description is so broad it could include anything from a hospital, to a clinic, to a World Health Organization, to an NGO, to any sort of Christian organization, missionary work, seminaries. It's so broad that there is really no real limitation on who, which public charity they could give money to.
What's an example of one or more of the or more specified?
An example of a class or a...
Because the taxpayer says, well, under your approach, you're wiping out the class opportunity here.
We aren't, Your Honor, because in the regulations, they give examples, examples one and two under that portion of the regulations. One example is a geographical limitation combined with an institutional limitation, such as all educational organizations or organizations of higher learning in the state of New York.
And how does that specification facilitate the purpose of the statute or your ability to enforce the statute any more than would saying all, as the parties have, all organizations that facilitate Christian virtues?
Well, in that class, that relatively narrowly defined class of New York educational organizations, there are public charities in that class, which are a specific discrete number. They generally have the same function and the same interests. And so if there are one or more charities in that class that are being funded by the supporting organization, then that those educational organizations can provide some degree of scrutiny and some degree of
wait a minute. What's the if? I missed the if. I understand that there's a limited number. Let's say 30. Public, now by public you mean state-owned universities, right?
Okay.
And colleges. So let's say 30 or 40, perhaps, in the state. And they have common objectives. I thought, in fact, they were rivalrous for faculty, rivalrous for students, rivalrous for contributors, rivalrous for football fans. I don't know what common interests they have.
Well, they may be rivals in those circumstances, but they are similar in the sense, not that they're cooperating with one another, but that they have similar interests in that they...
Well, their purpose is all higher education.
The purpose is higher education.
But this class has a common purpose, well, actually just two purposes, right? One having to do with health and one having to do with Christian values.
Well, that's true, but these organizations are so widely scattered and of such different character, of different interests, that there's really no way that any one of them...
They said public health and Christian virtues in the state of New York. Would that do it?
That would be better. I can't pass on the application that's not been made. I think I would want the IRS to take the first crack at that and look at all the circumstances.
I'm just posing a hypothetical that you're critical of the... You're answering the question about what does one or more mean, and you've said one or more could include, would be appropriate to include a geographic limit. Is that it?
Well, I think the key that the regulations are getting at is that if you don't specify them by name, you at least have to specify them by a class that is defined in such a way that you know which ones they are.
Well, is it that who knows? Is it so the IRS knows who they are?
Yes.
You can find them and ask them, are you in fact getting support?
Or any objective observer could understand what it means to have these educational organizations in the state of New York, for example. And there would be
we know what that would mean, but why that is acceptable, whereas educational organizations throughout the United States might not be, from what you're saying, is not apparent. And I thought in the brief there was some attempt to relate this limitation to the purpose or the administrability of the statute. Maybe I was reading virtues into the brief that aren't there.
That is one virtue of having a limited class or designation. But I should repeat that this is a narrow exception, that ordinarily every public charity has to be specified in the articles of incorporation.
And when you say ordinarily, the regulations have that option and they have this option. So what makes one the norm and the other the exception?
The statute says it has to be specified. And so specified must mean something.
One or more specified. So it could mean named. It doesn't say named, but that could be interpreted to mean named. But specificity is a matter of degree. Right? And looking for some reason to think that the degree is too great in the degree of specificity is insufficient in the charter here, sets us off in asking, well, what are the criteria for being too much or too little. And I'm not hearing you tell me about administrability or finding out who they are or checking up on them or anything. I mean, you're just saying it's a continuum and the IRS has to draw a line somewhere, but we don't even know where they draw it. This is just one instance here.
Well, I think it comes back to knowing who the public charities are.
Why?
Well, because...
is it for audit purposes? I mean, is there...
Well, I think this helps the IRS make the determination of whether there is any kind of real relationship between the public charity and the private foundation. Because if the private foundation can give its money essentially to anyone at any time under this broad rubric, then there's very little public scrutiny that's going to be directed from the public charity to the private foundation, which is what this whole system is set up to
do. The public charity, which is a recipient, you mean?
Which is the recipient, yes, sir.
Well, if I'm a public charity and a recipient, does it matter to me that there are 12 other or 100 other recipients and that they might change from year to year, as opposed to there are two?
Well, I think if you are a public charity receiving this and you know that you are among a limited class, I think you would have a greater incentive, at least, to look back at that private foundation and find out if it's being run properly, if the money's being used what it's supposed to be.
And as a supplicant, a beggar at the table, how do I find out what the master is doing with the rest of the money?
Well, if you are in that limited class, you do have some relationship with that private foundation, and presumably there is both an incentive and a means for that public charity.
Well, the relationship is that they give me money. Okay, I'm the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and they give me money.
Right.
Now, what is it that enables me, or I understand the incentive, but do I have the ability, because I'm a recipient, to have visitorial powers?
Well, I think if we look at the other example under the regulations, there can also be operational limitations. This is example two in the regs. For example,
is this a change of argument or an answer to that question?
It is an answer to that question in that there's more than one way to skin the cat, essentially. What you're looking for there in that other example was a private foundation that was operating, or a supporting organization that was operating a old age home for a church. And that church was not named specifically in the articles of incorporation of the private foundation, but it was still held to be a supporting organization. And the reason I bring that up is that you don't have to say which church it is, because in that instance it was operating a function for the church. There were longstanding ties between the two organizations, and there is a reciprocity there, a back and forth that can occur. And so that's how the public charity can look back and provide some scrutiny.
I thought that was an example given under the relationship test, not the organizational test.
This was under the organizational test, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah, it was under the regs. It's section 1.509A-4D23, example 2.
What exactly is the advantage of becoming a supporting, qualifying as a supporting organization? What's the...
There are a number of them, Your Honor. A private foundation is subject to a number of taxes, additional taxes, excise taxes. There's a 2% excise tax on net investment income for a private foundation that's not applicable to a public charity or a supporting organization. There's a 10% tax on self-dealing, in other words, an exchange of assets between the foundation and the disqualified person. There's a 30% tax on undistributed income and other taxes along those lines. There are also contribution limits that are different depending on whether the organization is a private foundation or a public charity. For example, there is generally a 50% limit on the deductibility of contributions to a public charity, whereas if you're giving money instead to a private foundation, there's a 30% limitation. That is 30% of the donor's adjusted gross income. So in other words, you can give more money to a public charity than you can to a private foundation. There are a number of examples like that.
You said in the organizational, can you point me to this example of the church in the organizational text?
Sure. In the regulations, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Yes.
If that's where you found it.
Yes, it's section
You're
one.
Brief, isn't it?
Anywhere, if you'll just point it out to me.
Sure, it's 1.509A.
Well, where am I to find it?
Oh, in the...
I
We discussed this section of the regulations in page 41, trailing on to page 42 of our brief, example 2. M is an organization described in section 501c3, which was organized and operated by representatives of N Church to run a home for the aged. Mm-hmm. So in this instance, just to paraphrase it, that even though the name of the church was not specified in the Articles of Incorporation, it was sufficient because it was performing a function for this church, and there was a long-standing temporal function and a purpose of organized religion, and so it was known which church would be supported in that instance.
The interpretation that you're giving us, you derive from the two examples that the church and then the New York Higher Education. But is there any official IRS ruling supporting that interpretation? This is an unusual situation because there would have been, but for the fact that the foundation sued before the IRS had made its determination. But there is there any official determination by the Internal Revenue Service as opposed to the Department of Justice?
As to the particular circumstances here?
Right. Well, either that or the interpretation that you're of these two examples that you're giving us, which are IRS regs.
In the regulations, no, Your Honor. The answer is no. As far as a revenue ruling on these specific facts, I'm not aware of any. But these are the examples that are set out in the regulations to give guidance to private foundations in setting up their articles of incorporation.
Is there any further commentary on this by the Internal Revenue Service?
I'm not under the organizational test, Your Honor.
Right.
I'm not aware of that. Certainly not in the regulations or, of course, in the statute.
This is the Internal Revenue Service's interpretation of the word specified in the statute? Is that what it is?
Yes. These regulations do elaborate on the word specified. And if I see my time is up, but I only wanted to say in conclusion that the foundation has to meet all three elements of the test, including the relationship test, which we've not discussed, and they don't meet that one also. If there are no further questions, I'll rest on our brief.
That's the common supervision requirement?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. We believe that they do not meet the relationship test because the distinguishing feature of that test is that there must be common supervision or control among the governing bodies of all the organizations involved. That's what the regulations say. And this is to ensure that the supporting organization will be responsive to the public charity and an integral part of the public charity's work. And the test is not met here. And in fact, I think if we just look at the history of this application for recognition, we see that the new bylaws that were adopted by the foundation delete any reference at all to specific charities. They used to have a list of 11 charities, and that's gone, even though they weren't obliged to donate to those charities to begin with. And as I say, the class of charities here is so broad as to eliminate the possibility of any close relationship between the foundation and
the
public.
How would that relationship, they have to satisfy the organizational test and the relationship test and the control test, right?
Yes, sir.
So looking at the example that you gave us under the organizational test, the first example in which X is an organization that operates for the benefit of institutions of higher learning in the state of Y, you say X is controlled by these institutions. That goes to the control issue. And they're all Section 509A1 organizations. They'll meet the test, the organizational test, if they require X to operate for the benefit of institutions of higher learning. How could they meet the relationship test?
It would depend on other factors in that case. This example only sets out the factors that are relevant to the organizational test. And it could meet or not meet the relationship test based on whatever else was in the Articles of Incorporation, for example.
But they have to be under common supervision with all of the institutions of higher learning in the state of New York that are potential beneficiaries. Right? Well, those institutions aren't under common supervision themselves except by the Board of Regents of the state of New York.
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought the language of the regs was one or more, that they have to have
relationship. Well, the regulations say that it's all.
One or more is in the class definition, the organizational test, but the relationship test says all, right?
Well, Your Honor, the other factor here is that because the in the current case, that the class of public charities is so broad, and the fact that the foundation can choose to stop funding any particular public charity at any given time, there's simply no possibility of a close relationship between the private foundation on the one hand and the public charity, or any public charity, even one. If even just one were required rather than all, they still wouldn't meet the test here. And the only one they point to really is having any sort of relationship with the foundation is the Mid-Atlantic Community Church, where Mr. Palm is a member and an elder. Now, if Mr. Palm wished to set up a foundation to support his church, he could have done so, as in example three under the relationship test regulations. In that example, the sole purpose of that trust was to support a church, and every member of the trust governing body was a member of the church and held important positions there. Mm-hmm. Now, critically, the successors of the trustees there were picked by the remaining trustees and would also be church leaders. Here, of course, they're picked by Mr. Palm, not by church trustees necessarily, and there's no requirement that they have any particular connection to the Mid-Atlantic Community Church. So if Mr. Palm wanted to set up a foundation to support his church, he could have done so. Example 3 gives him the blueprint to do so. That's a safe harbor, but that's not the case here at all. He was trying to do something very different, and that's the reason why the IRS denied his application.
Of the three tests that you've argued, which is the most obvious in your view? Which one do you think the foundation most obviously fails to meet?
The control test, Your Honor. First, because there are no questions about whether that has been waived by the agency or not. It's certainly before this court. And also, we haven't waived any of the other elements of the test either, but they claim we have. The other thing is that the control test is pretty straightforward in the way that the regulations give the IRS the power to look at all pertinent facts and circumstances, which here, of course, would include the person who...
It says that, but then there's a long series of examples, all of which have to do with the investments made by the foundation.
Yes, investments and also majority vote, yes.
Suggesting that all the facts or circumstances has been limited by the principle of eustem generis.
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor. I think they talk about majority vote, but then later it does say all pertinent facts and circumstances. And here I think you can't require the IRS to ignore the pertinent facts and circumstances about who appoints and replaces those board members who are voting. If you look just at the votes themselves, you know, whether those board members are named Palm or not, whether they're disqualified people or not, and pay no attention at all to what else is happening, well, that would be telling the IRS, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. You know, you have to look, I think you have to look at what is actually happening. And other code sections, as the foundation points out, other code sections that are not specifically related here, they define control in terms of voting power solely. It says that in the statute. Here, this statute, 509A3, does not say that control is equivalent to voting power, as other sections of the code do. They want to transplant these other sections of the code into 509A3, and it doesn't make sense to do so, and the IRS has said that that is not legitimate.
Before you sit down, Mr. Schuman, I need to point out that I erred in thinking that the one or more test did not appear also, or just the standard does not appear also in relation to the relationship test as well as the organizational. So if you have another question, Judge Griffith, this is
subsection 3. 152, supervised or controlled in connection with one or more supervisors.
So it's in both places, okay. You have a follow-up question on that? Okay, great. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Schumann.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kalina.
May it please the court. Supporting organizations are a unique animal. It is counterintuitive that supporting organizations would have on its board the very charities that it supports. But that's exactly what Congress required, and that's exactly what the regulations require. There are issues as far as control. If you appoint somebody, are they going to do as you ask, or are they not going to do as you ask? That is an intelligent and rational question. But that is, although it's counterintuitive, that's what the regulations require. That's what the statutes require. That's what the legislative history supports. This is absolutely clear that the individuals that are appointed are supposed to have a close relationship with the supporting organization. And in our particular example, for example, you deal with the relationship test. We had an executive committee that ran the day-to-day operations, controlled the president, and the executive committee had two people on it, Mr. Palm and Mr. Schramm, who was the pastor at the church involved. Mr. Schramm had majority vote. Mr. Schramm also ran the church that was one of the supported organizations. And that's exactly what the statute asks for. It asks that the people supervising the supporting organization also supervise the one or more of the supported organizations.
What happens to every in the in which test is it? You have an argument that every doesn't mean all.
Your Honor, the IRS and the government has argued that all the supporting orgs and all of the charities have to have common directors.
That's what the regulation says.
Your Honor, the regulation that says that is 1-509A-4H, and it's -4F4, and it's a lead-in to more specific regulations that do not require that. There are numerous instances, for example, private letter rulings, example 3, and the regulations under H that do not require this quote-unquote all status to exist. It doesn't really mean all. That's the entire argument of the government and the district court is predicated upon that one word.
So you're saying in the examples that they then give, it's not met?
Correct, Your Honor. In example 3 on -4H, 1.509A-4H, I think it's 2, example 3.
Is that the one we were just looking at with regard to higher education?
That is an example where there were multiple churches, and there was no requirement that all churches have common directors.
Talking about the test under the organizational?
No, Your Honor. This is under the relational test. And the IRS would have us read all, but if they read all, they've eliminated the very possibility of a class. The existence of a class is something that exists in the tax-exempt world, and it is very common to have classes and to get to classes. In this particular case, Mr. Palm wanted to live within the regulations and have one or more charities supervising his supporting org, but be able to give to multiple organizations. And if you look at the regulations under 1.509A4D, I think it's D2, that you will find that an organization can be a member of the supported class even though it only has purposes that are similar. So there is broad authority to have multiple charities. The question is, do you satisfy the relation test? And supervised and controlled is the question. And with respect to control, Your Honors, the issue of control has historically, even if you look at the regs of the IRS, in this area, they're all predicated under subparagraph J, they're all predicated upon vote. And the only instance where they talk about facts and circumstances is where they talk about investments, as Judge Ginsburg related. And what the IRS and the government has done is they are not living up to their own regulations. We are asking this court, we would like to know what the rules are. We tried to follow the rules, but we are finding out that these are shifting sands.
Mr. Kalina, you're, at least in terms of the space allotted in your brief, your main defense to the relationship test is that the government didn't properly raise it.
No, Your Honor. We addressed the procedural issue, but we addressed.
Well, you spend more time on the procedural issue than on the other. And what I'm not clear about is what your if you can give me the sequence. You filed before the Internal Revenue Service made a decision, and then the government answered. And how does the relationship issue get before the district court?
I don't know, Your Honor. That's one of our questions. We don't know how the relationship test can be brought up before the district court, except within the concept or the construct of a de novo hearing, and that the court can look, as can this court, they can look at the facts and make a decision as to the law, regardless of what arguments have been made and what arguments have not been made. That's the only way the relationship test comes up. We argued that the government ought to be in a position where if they're going to raise the relationship test, they should have raised it in the administrative record.
Well, they never reached the final decision, right?
Your Honor, the statute under 7428 is structured so that they have 270 days to address the issue. We wrote to the IRS and said to them, look, if you don't address these issues, we're going to file in court and ask for a declaratory judgment. And they did not respond.
You filed after the 270-day?
Yes, sir. And we said, if you do not respond, we will file. The only issue at the time was the control test. And our argument is that's a mathematical test. That otherwise, we have shifting sands and Change All Souls and United Cancer case and similar cases. There are probably 8 or 9 cases where the courts, the Seventh Circuit, the tax court, the Court of Claims has said the IRS has to live with their regulations.
Excuse me, why do you say that was the only issue when you filed? How do you know what the revenue agent was?
I don't know what the revenue agent was thinking, but if they are going to raise an issue at that level, they never raised the issue of the relationship test.
You, in correspondence.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct.
Further questions?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Kalina.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.